Conditions, they are bad, and some of you are sad. You cannot see your enemy, the class that lives in luxury. You working folk are poor, will be forevermore, as long as you permit the few to guide your destiny. Shall we still be slaves and work for wages? It is outrageous, has been for ages. This earth by right belongs to toilers, and not to spoilers of liberty. The master class is small, but they have lots of gall. When we unite to gain our right, if they resist, we'll use our might. There is no middle ground. This fight must be one round to victory for liberty. Our class is marching on. Shall we still be slaves and work for wages? It is outrageous, has been for ages. This earth by right belongs to toilers, and not to spoilers of liberty.
So, working folk unite,
we must put up a fight to make us free from slavery and capitalistic tyranny. This fight is not in vain. We've got a world to gain. Will you be a fool, a capitalist tool, and serve your enemy? Shall we still be slaves and work for wages? It is outrageous, has been for ages. This earth by right belongs to toilers, and not to spoilers of liberty.
Hi, I'm Lynn Swanson, and I'm a proud member of the IWW Local Tacoma Branch, and I'm also WOB Radio. IWW equals Wobblies, and Wobblies equals WOB Radio. We have a pretty lively show once a month, and we really hope that you'll listen in and take note. We're involved with the labor struggles around the world, around the country. I'm a longtime union member, and I come from a union family. So I will pass it on to fellow worker Marilyn, and I am she, her.
And I'm Marilyn, and we're sitting around my dining room table doing this show today. I'm a longtime Wobbly since at least 2008. I'm a delegate, so if anybody out there would like to join the Wobblies, I would be glad to sign you up. What about me? I'm also president of Radio Tacoma, and one of the original members of the WOB radio show, which is what you're listening to. And I hope you enjoy the show. And I go by She Day.
Hi, I'm Gordon. He, him pronouns. I live in Bremerton, but I'm a member of the Tacoma General Membership Branch of the IWW. I've been a Wobbly since about 2008. Hope to continue the struggle of the working class for liberation. This is the preamble to the Constitution of the IWW. The working class and the employing class have nothing in common. There can be no peace so long as hunger and want are found among millions of the working people, and the few who make up the employing class have all the good things of life. Between these two classes, a struggle must go on until the workers of the world organize as a class, take possession of the means of production, abolish the wage system, and live in harmony with the earth. We find that the centering of the management of industries into fewer and fewer hands makes the trade unions unable to cope with the ever-growing power of the employing class. The trade unions foster a state of affairs which allows one set of workers to be pitted against another set of workers in the same industry, thereby helping defeat one another in wage wars. Moreover, the trade unions and the employing class the trade unions aid the employing class to mislead the workers into the belief that the working class have interests in common with their employers. These conditions can be changed and the interest of the working class upheld only by an organization formed in such a way that all its members in any one industry, or in all industries if necessary, cease work whenever a strike or a lockout is on in any department thereof, thus making an injury to one an injury to all. Instead of the conservative motto, a fair day's wage for a fair day's work, we must inscribe on our banner the revolutionary watchword, abolition of the wage system. It is the historic mission of the working class to do away with capitalism. The army of production must be organized not only for everyday struggle with capitalists, but also to carry on production when capitalism shall have been overthrown. By organizing industrially, we are forming the structure of the new society within the shell of the old.
Turning now towards labor news here in the U.S. and abroad, this is an article coming out of The Guardian. This was published back on March 10th, so just earlier this last month. The Guardian is talking about major U.S. corporations threaten to return labor to law of the jungle. And this article is by Stephen Greenhouse, again, for The Guardian, which is a U.K. outlet. Upset by the surge in union drives, several of the best-known corporations in the U.S. are seeking to cripple the country's top labor watchdog, the National Labor Relations Board, the NLRB, by having it declared unconstitutional. Some labor experts warn that if those efforts succeed, U.S. labor relations might return to a, quote, law of the jungle. In recent weeks, Elon Musk's SpaceX, as well as Amazon, Starbucks, and Trader Joe's, have filed legal papers that advance novel arguments aimed at hobbling and perhaps shutting down the NLRB, the federal agency that enforces labor rights and oversees unionization efforts. Those companies are eager to thwart the NLRB after it accused Amazon, Starbucks, and Trader Joe's of breaking the law in battling against unionization, and accused SpaceX of illegally firing 8 workers just for criticizing Elon Musk. Roger King, a longtime management side lawyer who is senior labor counsel for the HR Policy Association, said it will be a lose-lose if the federal courts overturn the 89-year-old National Labor Relations Act, which has governed labor relations since Franklin Roosevelt was president. Quote, we'll have a law of the jungle, the law of the streets, King said. Quote, it will be who has the most power. It's a potential for chaos. Another law professor, Katie Andreas from Columbia University, said that workers would be hurt if the courts issue a sweeping decision that declares both the NLRB and the National Labor Relations Act unconstitutional. This isn't just about dismantling the NLRB. This is also about ruling the National Labor Relations Act, the Wagner Act of 1935, unconstitutional. In a quote from Katie Andreas, without them, the workers would be even worse off. Quote, it's critical that they continue to exist to protect the basic right to organize and engage in collective bargaining. This is an assault on rights we have considered fundamental since the New Deal. That's back in 1933. So from what I have heard from other labor-related news outlets is that this situation is still ongoing. I know we reported about it last month. There have been some indicators that these lawsuits by these four titans of industry in this country might fail. Because the reason why these major corporations are filing these lawsuits against the NLRB in the first place is that they're accusing the NLRB of essentially infringing on their First Amendment rights. To tell workers in their workplaces that the companies have free speech, because as we all know, a company is a person, as this country has decided, and therefore the company has free speech to speak against unions and to dissuade unionization efforts. However, the companies have been doing this in a blatantly illegal way, which the National Labor Relations Board has called them out for in unfair labor practices filed by their workers.
So they want to make the NLRB illegal.
Basically. The only watchdog that kind of manages labor relations on a federal level could potentially stop existing because of these lawsuits.
That sounds so Trumpian of them.
Right, but it's also hypocritical in the sense that they are also infringing on workers and unions from being able to freely assemble and freely speak in regards to grievances that they have in their workplace and against their employers.
Yeah.
It's basically a legal argument of, we want the First Amendment to protect only our speech, but your First Amendment rights were free to infringe.
How far do you think they're going to get?
With the Supreme Court stacked in a conservative direction that it is, it really depends on whether or not it gets to the Supreme Court in the first place, in my opinion.
And also, who's president. That'll have a big influence, too. And
also, those titans of industry that you mentioned have just virtually limitless supplies of money.
Really not optimistic, are you?
No, I'm not. Personally, I'm not optimistic. They overturned Roe v. Wade. You know, which point was taken. The law of the land.
Yeah, point taken.
We've spoken about this before in the previous episode, that there's a potential silver lining to this. And I know that the situation is very bleak because even though some of us in the IWW definitely kind of side-eye labor law and labor management from a government organization especially, I think that the opportunity for organization caused by a situation like this has probably never been better. If there's nothing federally saying that we can't engage in solidarity strikes, secondary strikes, yeah, general strikes, sit-down strikes, you know, working to rule other tactics that labor unions have been successful with in the past that the NLRB says we can't do anymore, a dissolution of the NLRB might lead to more militant labor organizing because of a lack of a federal body that says you can't do this, you can't do that as a union.
I'd like to point out that when the NLRA was passed in 35, the Wagner Act, 12 years later, there was another labor law passed that pretty much hamstrung what unions could do, and that's the Taft-Hartley Act of 1947.
Right. That's the one.
And that's the body of law that prevents solidarity strikes, secondary boycotts, very well enumerated. And that used to be traditionally how the labor movement got a lot of stuff done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's what industrial organizing actually means.
Which I guess is kind of something that isn't being talked about in this case.
No.
The Taft-Hartley Act is built on top of the Wagner Act,
yes,
as a limitation to some of the provisions it gave to the benefits for unions.
Yep.
So they're only, these companies are only targeting the National Labor Relations Board, which was created by the National Labor Relations Act, the Wagner Act, as you mentioned. So would Taft-Hartley still be around?
That's what I'm asking.
If the NLRA and the NLRB
mm-hmm.
were dissolved by these companies in these major lawsuits? That is an interesting question because, again, trying to stay optimistic about this, labor unions could do a hell of a lot more to the benefit of workers. But on the other hand, having that regulatory body be dissolved means that companies can get away with damn near anything anymore.
That's right.
Wouldn't child labor come back in?
Oh, yeah, it's already back.
Yeah.
They have found children as young as 10 to 13 years old working in slaughterhouses, in fast 13, food. But it is kind of a weird situation to be living through as somebody who really gives a damn about unions, especially everybody here at this table.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't know what's going to come of this because, like fellow worker Gordon said, these companies have a lot of not just money, but political clout because of that money. You know, SpaceX, all of these major industries, even Trader Joe's, have billions of dollars to their name that they could potentially use in these lawsuits.
And they will.
Whereas the labor unions, I know we like to think that they're flush with dues money or something like that, which is kind of an anti-union talking point. They really do not have the kind of financial and legal backing. I mean, the longshoremen, the ILWU, like we just talked about a couple of episodes ago, are kind of facing a bankruptcy crisis right now. Yeah, because of one lawsuit from one employer down in Portland, Oregon, at some of their ports, said, you guys spent too much time on strike and you caused us damages to our net profit, so therefore we're going to fine you.
Shades of the concrete workers here up in the Seattle area.
Mm-hmm.
They busted their labor action
specifically
for that reason, and that could have definite repercussions.
And I think at the end of the day, this is for the union, this situation regarding the National Labor Relations Act and the NLRB is kind of up to the unions to respond to. I think it will be very interesting to see how the officers of major trade unions are going to react to this, because mm-hmm. as we've talked about in the past, some of them are definitely more gung-ho about reinvigorating the labor movement, getting militant, getting educated, organized, whatever. And then there's still definitely a body of trade union officers who are like, well, we'll do what we can to kind of keep the labor peace, make sure that we still exist, you know, play how we're supposed to play with our employers. I think the IWW specifically might find advantage in this as well, because we've always been kind of, and I'm sorry to use a word that's probably not very popular in the IWW, we have been kind of the vanguard of the older revolutionary style of unionism that said, no, we are a united body of class-conscious workers who recognize that all of our struggles are intertwined
mm-hmm.
on the basis of, you know, economics, social status, race, sex, et cetera, et cetera. So, I don't know.
IWW definitely broke a lot of paradigms, and they were formed specifically to oppose the business unionism, and that's an expression that's we still use of the AFL, the American Federation of Labor, or as some wobbly wags put it, the American Separation of Labor. So we were formed, the IWW, specifically in a response to the adoption of business type practices. That was Sam Gompers who did that, who founded the AFL. He said, you know, if we're going to be taken seriously, we have to act like these guys. And they promptly went around acting like captains of industry. So we're opposed to that, and we organize industrially.
What I'm genuinely concerned about is the potential for violence against people that stand up and speak out if this does get shot down.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's now the coin of the realm is political violence, which echoes to, you know, all the successful fascist movements ever have employed political violence to get their way.
Yeah.
I, for one, would like to separate two different definitions of violence in this specific context. There is violence against, let's say, the machinery of capital, and then there's violence against people.
Mm-hmm.
When we talk about, as the IWW does, you know, we have lots of songs and poems, and in a lot of our pamphlets, we talk about sabotage. People hear that word and they think of, you know, the Luddites of the 1800s in England breaking up the looms and stuff because they didn't like the Industrial Revolution. That's not what we're talking about when we talk about sabotage. When we talk about sabotage, we're talking about withholding our labor or making our labor as difficult as possible to gain profit from for the purpose of pressuring our employers for better wages, hours, and conditions. Now, in the context of interpersonal violence, which I think, fellow worker Marilyn, that's what you're talking about,
yeah,
violence against labor organizers, violence against people on picket lines, that still has always occurred, even with all of these labor protections. I mean, just recently, there was a case, I believe here in the United States, of a aerospace worker who was late to work because there were picketers protesting for Palestine, blocking people from going to work. And the guy who was trying to go to work pulled out a knife, and I think he stabbed one of them.
No, he threatened them.
Okay.
Yeah.
My correction then. But
he also threatened to run them down.
Yeah, that's their favorite weapon now these mm-hmm. days of the right.
The threat of violence on an interpersonal level, like bodies to bodies, I think has always been there. And I think in a situation where the NLRA and the NLRB get dissolved, I definitely agree with you that the possibility of violence between people would definitely increase. And I think it would be to the benefit of the companies because, as we've talked about in labor history, you know, there's the Pinkertons, there's anti-union militias that have formed. We've talked about the Centralia massacre.
Who gets pointed out is the people that stand up.
Historically, it's the people who stand up for organized labor who face violence, and the people who do violence against them get away with it. I mean, this happened with, you know, people in Central and South America as well.
Mm-hmm.
I, for one, I don't want to sound like I'm glorifying violence on that level, but I do think that union folks need to keep in the back of their heads that some of that violence, especially in self-defense, was kind of how we got to where we are today. We have to be willing to accept that possibility and plan for it in the future, whether that's in this situation or way back when.
All very well and good.
Mm-hmm.
And those people who can afford to do that, that's fine. But you have to understand that a lot of fellow workers have children and families that depend on them, and they don't have the luxury of putting themselves in that kind of physical danger. Just keep aware of that. I always think to myself, before I advocate for something that sounds wonderful and brave, I have to look at, am I willing to risk that injury myself?
Mm-hmm.
So this may be an organizing opportunity, but I am very concerned about it.
Mm-hmm. Right. And again, that's kind of why I hesitate to glorify it in any way, because as much as we like to look back on the labor struggles of ages ago where that kind of violence was expected and was normal to a certain extent, like you said, those were people with families and friends and communities, and when those people got killed, it is a huge loss to bear, especially mm-hmm. for the working class, which doesn't have the kind
especially for their families.
Yes.
Right.
So I guess it's kind of a... to use the original term correctly, you gotta stay woke about this. You gotta be aware and awake of the fact that violence has been a part of labor history. And if that comes back because of these court rulings, that companies can get away with a hell of a lot of what they used to not be able to get away with, including violence, we need to keep that in the back of our heads, and we need to find a way to strategize around that possibility.
You know, this brings up for me an issue that I consider, you know, Bill McKibben's program called The Third Act?
I believe I have, yes.
Okay. That's for older people that are probably retired by now, what they can do to stay relevant and productive in the struggle for the planet or any other issue. One of the things that we retirees can do is, since we're no longer raising young ones, since so many of us are retired, we have the luxury of being able to risk being arrested and go to jail. Mm-hmm. And that's something to keep in mind. If the fellow workers that are young, that are struggling, that are dependent on their paycheck, that are maybe raising families, can't afford to get their heads smashed in or get arrested, if we're able to, that's something that the older ones can do.
You bring up a really good point. We might not be actively employed or in a workplace,
but we don't have to be irrelevant.
We don't have to be irrelevant, and we do have a certain luxury, which is more time.
Yeah, because it takes us four times as long to get ready in the morning.
You're right. There are roles to play in how we respond to this. And I mean, not to provide a counter argument, but to also add on to that, you know, we've also seen a lot of younger people kind of become more aware of the issue regarding labor unions in this country, even an environmentalism, which we've touched on in the past. You know, there have been those mass protests where lots and lots of young people look at the climate situation and go, no, we actually need to escalate these tactics. We're going to go occupy a coal field in Germany by the hundreds, if not by the thousands, and hold up that machinery as long as possible. I think that, again, it's very brave, but only because those people calculated the risk in the back of their head and said, is this worth it? Mm-hmm. Can I put myself on the line like that? We can't all throw ourselves at the barricades, metaphorically speaking, you know. If everyone, you know, shows up just to fight, then who's going to provide care for the children? Who's going to provide community support, exactly, financial support, things like that? Yeah. Find your role and find your place.
Mm-hmm. And any contribution of labor or material resources will be of assistance. And also the morale of younger workers. If younger workers see a bunch of old farts out there protesting against their employer, sort of a by proxy, right? Mm-hmm. They could gain confidence and gain, you know, courage for their on their own.
Yeah.
So for our second piece of labor-related news, we're going to turn right back here to Tacoma, Washington, specifically the Port of Tacoma. The ILWU, Local 23, has recently organized at Wallenius Wilhelmsen Logistics. This is a major car importer and shipper for this part of the country. The International Longshoremen and Warehouse Union, you said?
Warehouse Worker Union.
Okay.
He used to say warehousemen, but they made it gender neutral.
Yeah. All right. I had just heard the initials.
Well, I'd like to point out that ILWU was organized as an industrial union because the warehousemen were separate. The guys who worked the piers were separate. Mm-hmm. And then they even had more distinctions. The guy who worked the hatch was different. So it had a different union. So, and they would all get hired on a shape up. Your dad might have told you about the shape up, perhaps. Well, that's basically the slave market. Mm-hmm. And all these guys who wanted to work that day
lined up
had to show up.
Oh, casual labor.
Well, yes, that's what they call it, casual now, right? That's a specific rank, I guess you'd say, in the ILWU. Okay.
But this was different.
Yeah, Harry Bridges, well-known communist agitator out of Australia, was the founder, one of the founders of ILWU. He organized it industrially, you know, because why have three or four separate unions, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the ILWU, the International Longshoremen and Warehouse Worker Union, Local 23 here in Tacoma, recently organized with Wallenius Wilhelmsen Logistics. I personally briefly worked with them to kind of give a brief description of the country. They do a lot of logistics and imports, especially in the auto industry. Back on March 21st, the workers at Wallenius Wilhelmsen down here in the Port of Tacoma successfully voted for a union after a pretty substantial campaign. They did have a couple of pickets over the past few months, but on March 21st, this is off of the ILWU Local 23 Facebook page, workers at the Wallenius Wilhelmsen Auto Processing Facility in Tacoma, Washington, successfully defended their right to organize and voted 104-56 to join the ILWU Local 23.
Yeehaw.
So they are currently in contract negotiations at the moment. They have their win, which is cool. But to give some context for the listeners, once you win a union in your workplace, it's usually a period of time afterwards where the union representatives of the workers in that particular shop and company representatives get together in a room and they talk out what a union contract with the company is going to look like. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where they're at right now. So I think that that's pretty cool. To kind of also give a little bit more context, the ILWU is a pretty powerful union, especially here in the Pacific Northwest. They have a lot of different ports and related industries organized.
Up and down the Pacific coast up to Alaska.
Oh, yeah.
Dutch Harbor, all the way down to San Pedro.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think that it's really cool that there's been a ILWU victory here in the Port of Tacoma. I know that there are other shops in the port that are also organized with the ILWU. Obviously, it's the Port of Tacoma. Mm-hmm. It's, I think, one of the top six largest ports on the west coast of the United States, which is pretty impressive. So all of our kudos and all of our shout-outs to the ILWU Local 23 for this organizing campaign. I really hope that the workers get some good negotiations and a good contract. So that's just kind of a brief report on that situation. I am hoping within the next month to sit down with a couple of workers from this local and do an interview with them, because I think it'd be really cool to talk about the organizing process that they went through and what that campaign looked like from the inside. I think that would be...
That would be a great story.
Absolutely. I know that we've previously done an interview like that with the Tacoma art workers.
Right.
Museum workers specifically here at the Tacoma Art Museum. I'd love to do one of those interviews again. Those interviews are always great. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the conclusion of labor news as we currently have it.
Well, I have something I want to talk about.
Go ahead.
Okay. So from a very unlikely source, my source is the Magazine of National Parks. I'm going to give you the name. It's called the National Parks.
What do you know?
And I was just perusing it to see if there was anything worthwhile reading in there. I found two things, but the first thing I want to talk about is directly related to labor. And there is an article here called The Women Behind the Brotherhood. The writer is Catherine DeGroff. She's associate editor of the National Parks magazine. And she wanted to talk about the little-known story of the wives and maids who helped propel the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters to a groundbreaking agreement with the Pullman Company. And I had never thought about the women behind the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. So in the late 1920s, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters was on an all-court press to be recognized as a labor union by the railroad car company, then the nation's leading employer of black workers. I'm reading from the article. They talk about a woman here called Carruthers Tucker. Carruthers Tucker had married a Pullman porter, and you have to understand, the listener has to understand, all of the Pullman porters were black men.
Right.
The Pullman company decided to put sleeping cars in their trains. And so they wanted all black porters, black men to be porters, and then they wanted maids to be all black women. And they were taken from a pool directly of freed slaves. And they were strictly kept separate from each other. Sort of sounded like the airlines at the very early part.
Mm-hmm.
Women were not allowed to be married. If you were pregnant, you were fired. They made much less money than the white workers working on the Pullman cars. And there was a lot of beef about that. And so the porters in particular were very dissatisfied and were really pushing to unionize. Well, if they spoke up, they could be fired immediately.
Mm-hmm.
So the wives, who were not employees, knew that they couldn't be fired. So they did a major part of the push. And this is something that isn't usually acknowledged. And this was news to me, so I wanted to share it with the listener. So they talk about several women that really helped push this. So Rosina Carruthers Tucker was married to a porter. And she also worked at the Pullman Company. Well, her husband got fired because she spoke up. And they blamed him for her actions. And she was not going to take it lying down. So here's what she did. When her husband was suspended, she was repeatedly stonewalled by the superintendent when she tried to talk with him. So she marched straight to the superintendent's boss. This is a quote. "I want to tell you that nobody has anything to do with what I do," she said, pounding on a desk in the Union Station. "You hired my husband. You didn't hire me." Then she lobbed an ultimatum. She said, "You take care of this matter or I'll be back." And this is back, I said the 1920s, and that's out of context. This is way back in the 18, I'm going to find it.
80s somewhere. And 90s.
Yeah, way back. So he was so taken aback by the gall of this black woman that he figured there had to be somebody powerful behind her. And he actually backed off. He backed off and he rehired the husband.
She bluffed him.
Yeah, she bluffed him. Yeah. So the Carruthers Tucker is just one woman of many who helped propel the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters to success. She and other porters' wives, along with Pullman maids, because the maids weren't paid squat practically, conducted door-to-door canvassing, fundraised, ran local chapters, hosted dinners for visiting Brotherhood leaders. In 1935, after a decade of effort, the men and the women prevailed. The Brotherhood became the first black-led union to have its charter approved by the American Federation of Labor.
But so, noticeably, it was a segregated union structure.
Yes.
But it was major progress just to be recognized.
Yes, yes. For the listener, today the Brotherhood's labor rights saga is memorialized by the National A. Philip Randall Pullman Porter Museum, founded by a woman. The Pullman National Historical Park in Chicago, currently run by women, and by countless books and videos. I believe we have an office here in Tacoma. And if you go to the Labor Council in Tacoma, I believe it's upstairs. There are more women that it talks about in this article.
Mm-hmm.
I found it very uplifting in dark times. First taste of their collective organizing toward the Pullman Brotherhood was in 1894, but that one was not successful. But they just kept going. And it talks about Frances Albrier, a nurse and a Pullman they called them maids.
Yeah.
Pullman maid. And basically they were waiting on white customers.
Right.
Provided manicures to riders to help elevate the Pullman train experience. But the company expected the maids to purchase their own supplies,
right,
their own uniforms, their own equipment, and they didn't pay them nearly what they paid white people.
Relying on tips.
Yeah, yeah. So, believe it or not, national parks, that was a pretty good article.
Just for a little historical, filling out the story, Pullman, the guy who invented, basically, he was a carriage maker originally, and he saw that the condition of cross-country train travel was horrendous. You're in a day coach. So he actually invented the sleeping car.
Right.
And he became very successful. And what he did is he set up a company town, which is now part of Chicago. But it was a suburb of Chicago, and it was called, after him, Pullman. And it was a typical company town. You had a company store, company script. You had to buy stuff with their script. You couldn't use cash. It was just a closed community and had very strict rules for the renters. And they didn't provide squat for the black employees. They had to militate to get that right. And the Pullman maids There was a Pullman porter on every sleeping car, but the Pullman maids were restricted to only certain train runs, but maybe some of the longer train runs. Because they would also double as babysitters and things everything. Like that. Yeah. You could imagine back in the 1920s, especially going through the South or certain states out West, the horrendous treatment that people of color, black people especially, received at the hands of the white customers.
Oh, yeah.
Must have been. And another point about the Pullman porters is that they took great pride in keeping their uniforms immaculate. They were pillars of their communities because they were one of the few well-paid, you know, working class.
Relatively speaking.
And they were a source of pride for black communities across the country.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of, they were both the porters and the women were expected to receive tips as part of their earnings, or else bad luck. And can imagine how well people were tipped in the 20s and 30s.
Mm. Yeah.
A dime, maybe.
So as I was perusing this magazine, the National Parks magazine, they also had a very interesting article, which is not, well, it is relevant because it's about climate change and what human beings are doing to the planet. And it is specifically about Olympic National Park. It's called Requiem for Melting Ice by Kate Silber. And an art project at the Olympic National Park memorializes the national park's shrinking glaciers. And I just want to say that the woman who started the project's name is Eliza Good. She's a visual information specialist for Olympic National Park. They had some money become available to do this project. She saw how quickly visitors became overwhelmed when learning about how warming temperatures were affecting the park. Yet addressing the climate crisis is a critical part of her job, and they were getting so overwhelmed that they were turning away. So she thought that maybe if she used another medium, she could get through to people. The money became available in 2019. And so she put out a call to artists of all types to apply to be part of the project, a visual project. And out of something like 300 applicants, they chose about 30. And the display is currently on show at Olympic National Park at the headquarters. And I looked through and I was amazed. There were all kinds of things. There were paintings, there were weavings, there were felt 3D images. You're listening to the pages here. Sorry.
Could you please repeat where that art show is currently on display one more time?
At the Olympic National Park headquarters.
Thank you.
That's on 101, I think.
Yeah. I was really, really emotionally impacted.
So essentially what they're doing is they're documenting the retreat of the glaciers and the lack of snowpack. Is that what they're doing?
Yeah. This one, I mean, the listener can't see this, but here's three leaves showing the degree of the melting of one particular glacier from here to here. That's how much it shrunk. Each artist was assigned a particular glacier to document the shrinkage.
Okay.
It's quite amazing, the grief level as I looked at them. It's visually, it does come through.
Well, from just personal experience here, living in Bremerton, about 30 miles away from Tacoma, very prominently in almost any place in Bremerton, in the background you can see a mountain range called the Brothers. It's part of the Olympic Mountains, but it's, you know, it stands out. And I've noticed, I've been living in Bremerton since, I guess, about 1978, and I have witnessed myself seeing that the snowpack and the glaciers have shrank and shrank. We used to have it all year. Now it's pretty much gone by June.
Yeah. Here's one that they did. It's graphite and charcoal on a West Clock technical drawing. Why that? Because the reference to time frame. Time is ticking. And it's this shrinking glacier. This one here is one of my favorites. It's felt. They made a felt 3D image of the glacier.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is cool. So I intend to go up there and take a look at this in person because I just thought this was amazing. And if there's more than one of you out there that want to go, maybe we can do a field trip. Who knows?
As soon as I get my yellow school bus back from the shop, we can do it.
So this is by Kate Silber, and it's in the spring 2024 issue of National Parks. Thing on the front cover calls it The Long Goodbye.
Greetings, listeners and fellow workers out there in Radioland. This is a segment of our broadcast that's become sort of a regular feature, and it's a book review. And what I've been concentrating on is books that were pretty well directly or indirectly associated with our union, the Industrial Workers of the World. But I'm starting to see some of the books that can explain a lot of what's happening in today's political scene and today's labor scene from the past. And the book I'm going to review is called The Paranoid Style in American Politics. And for you old history buffs out there that might sound familiar, the author is Richard Hofstadter, numerous academic achievements, and he published several books. Among them is The American Political Tradition and The Men Who Made It. Notice, The Men Who Made It. And let's see, The Age of Reform from Bryan to FDR, and Anti-Intellectualism in American Life. And that's just a couple of his titles. But The Paranoid Style was written in 1963 it came out in 1964. And it describes pretty much what's going on today. He analyzed right-wing tendencies in American politics and how they've gone all the way back to the founding of the country. And he takes apart, okay, in the first part of the book, studies in the American right. He takes apart what he means by paranoid style. Paranoid was a word that was sort of just coming into circulation during the 60s. And he meant it not as a clinical observation, but he meant it as sort of the overall mindset of some of the right-wingers that he was talking about. And he goes back in history, but what he really took apart and analyzed bit by bit was the Goldwater campaign. Barry Goldwater, a very conservative senator out of Arizona. And for those who remember, he ran against Johnson, Lyndon Baines Johnson, who, of course, became president after Kennedy got assassinated. So in this mix, in the early 60s, also Medgar Evers got assassinated back then. The civil rights movement was becoming predominant and just getting off the ground in the face of horrible police repression. They called Birmingham Bombingham for a few years, for about a decade in Alabama. That's where those four little girls were blown up when they were going to Sunday school. And it was pretty hard times back then. So he takes apart the Goldwater campaign and the people who supported Goldwater. And I swear, you know, I first read this book as a teen because I was a history buff way back when. And then I got it again in 2008. That's my current edition. And by the way, it's published by Vintage Books. So you can look it up and from your favorite bookseller and you can get a copy of this. But when you read the part about the Goldwater campaign, you can pretty much substitute the name Goldwater with Trump. I mean, Trump is playing this playbook that goes way back. You think that, you know, he's kind of new on the scene and he's kind of outrageous. Well, there were people like him. Back then in the 60s, the John Birch Society was still an ongoing thing. It's been largely discredited these days. But then worse people came in. You got your 3%ers and your Oath Keepers and your Proud Boys and stuff.
And not my Oath Boys.
No, they're not my Proud Boys either, or my Oath Keepers, because they think they have a monopoly on what uses of violence and force can do for the right-wing movement. And they've threatened openly. Trump himself said he's going to be dictator on day one. Well, probably every day after that, too. but it's something to worry about. And let me tell you a little bit about Hofstadter himself. He was considered one of the revisionist or progressive historians of his day. And he introduced a lot of analysis that didn't go along with the mainstream. He was in no way do I think that he was any kind of socialist. He would be called a progressive or a liberal these days. But he really, really turned a spotlight on the mindset of the characters who that are currently inhabiting our right-wing political scene. So the book is worthwhile just to see that there's historical precedent to what's going on now. A lot of younger people, young voters, this is all new. You know, the Trump movement and the MAGA movement is all new to them. But what Hofstadter shows is that it goes all the way back to the colonial days, and which is also illustrated by another book, which I'm going to do next month, I hope. But what I'm getting at is that Hofstadter really takes it apart, but he takes it apart in a style that's easy to read. He's what we call accessible. He's a historian, and the book is loaded with endnotes and footnotes and an index, but he has a satirical bent to his prose style. So it's kind of a little quasi-gonzo journalist style. And he talks about, he makes it clear that the paranoid style is not unique to America, although the American style is unique. I mean, really, you know, it has its own, you know, red, white, and blue colored, you know, problems.
Well, certainly Hitler had his own paranoid style.
I think that Hitler was actually clinically a paranoid, but, you know.
Yeah.
But you got the picture correctly. Yeah. He shows that the Italian fascist movement,
Franco,
and the Civil War in Spain and all that. But it goes all the way back to the colonial era, which is like sort of a siege mentality that the settler colonists, European, you know, people of European heritage, had when they came over to the United States. And a lot of that was driven by religion. He really dissects some of the Calvinism and some of the puritanical religious streaks in American politics that, lo and behold, it's come back, right? So now we see a Christian right or a dominionist right wing. Dominionism meaning they believe in a Christian theocracy. They don't believe in a democracy. So it's pretty scary stuff. But to gain a really good understanding of what's going on in the minds of some of these people, I highly recommend this book.
Does he draw any conclusions that would be useful or any advice that you think might be useful in this day and age?
No, he withholds himself from that.
Okay.
But his satirical style, you know, for people who can appreciate satire and people who can appreciate, you know, sort of a wry, tongue-in-cheek attitude, his prose is perfect for it.
Okay.
So Hofstadter is a well-respected historian, and he gets a little scholastic, if you will. He gets a little academic, but he talks about Russia, how that happened, how that revolution got unhinged and taken into a fascistic direction, and, of course, the other European fascist movements. But he doesn't come out with any kind of, this is what we have to do. This is not a, you know, like a manual for revolution.
Okay.
But it's a good point, though, because these days, we would probably have, you know, he was writing as an academic and as a historian. So he wanted to keep that legitimacy that comes from well-researched historical tracts. And he succeeds remarkably. And if you read the book, you know, I mean, all kinds of names pop up. He talks about Frankfurt School people like Theodore Adorno. He talks about the America First movement.
Mm-hmm.
Which was back in the 30s, where we actually had Nazi rallies in Madison Square Garden. We actually had a national hero, Charles Lindbergh.
We had summer camps for junior Nazis.
Yes, we did. Nazi towns and stuff like that. It's pretty crazy. But that goes to show you that it was more accepted. And, you know, the Communist Party also had summer camps. Anarchists, and we talked a couple of episodes ago about the anarchist colony right here on the Key Peninsula.
Home,
right, which is now Lake Bay. I think there is an actual home
there
still
is.
There
is still home.
Yeah, but they made them moved their post office and so now...
Now there's a little bakery up there on the hill.
Is there?
Yeah.
Well, just to show you that America had many more different possibilities for political action that was accepted. I mean, maybe people disagreed with you. Maybe people will get into fights with you about it. But it was part of the scene, much like when you see news about European politics. You always hear, okay, the communists, still around, Communist Party joined forces with the Socialist Party, joined forces with other left-wing elements so they can have a voting bloc in mm-hmm. their parliament. In America, it's different. We're bifurcated. For all, you know, except for the Ross Perot candidacy back in, what was it, 92? Mm-hmm. Something like that. Ross Perot got 19% of the vote. Eugene Debs, a socialist, ran for president from prison and got like 6% of the vote, which mm-hmm. is substantial. But we're stuck with either the Democrats or the Republicans and their various wings and branches. So a lot could be said for parliamentary democracy. But anyway, in the book, he gives some pretty amusing histories of the various conservative movements and anti-union movements. And the last chapter, which was pretty baffling to me, the last chapter of the book was, Free Silver and the Mind of Coin Harvey. There was a guy named, his last name was Harvey, and he got the nickname Coin. And this was all about this kerfuffle that I did not understand between the gold standard and the silver standard, or bimetallism, as they called
it.
Oh,
yeah, that's a long-standing thing.
Oh, boy. And you'll see, even today, if you watch television, you'll see, buy gold, you know, and you can definitely get a conservative feel to it. Yeah, I'm buying gold because you can't trust fiat currency and blah, blah.
Yeah. Well,
all currencies fiat currency.
Our paper money used to be backed by gold bars and silver bars in the treasury, and now they're not anymore,
right.
Blah, blah, blah.
Federal Reserve notes, fiat currency, that kind of thing. So it became a little bit baffling because I don't understand capitalism very well. Socialism and anarchism makes way more sense to me, but that's my personal thing. But anyway, the last chapter might put you to sleep, which is unfortunate because the rest of the book is rich in detail for what was going on and the international connections. And we've heard anti-Semitic tropes these days, like international bankers. Well, that is a phrase that's a euphemism for Jewish people.
Also, cultural Marxism, which used to be, you know, what was it? Judeo-Bolshevism or something like
yeah.
that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jew communism. I specifically remember being called a Jew communist. I had to explain that I was an Episcopalian, but never mind. But Jews and communism were synonymous, and then Jews and international banking was synonymous. So, you know, one of those points of view is at least wrong. You know, at least one of them is wrong. And so, you know, because Jewish people are a big community all over the world, and they have as many different political viewpoints. As a matter of fact, you get two Jewish people in a room and you end up with three political parties. Yeah. But anyway, I recommend the book highly. For those who are interested, if you have a historical bent, it's very good reading. That's my personal favorite genre. Is history, because it explains what's happening today in large part. But also, you can see what's going on in the country that goes way back to when the pilgrims landed. And the kind of paranoia that is exhibited, you know, they're coming to take our jobs. That's a favorite thing you'll hear from the MAGA right, you know. They're taking our jobs. Yeah, okay. How about you go down to Florida and pick oranges you know, if you want a job that badly? Crickets, right? But what I'm saying is that if you want to understand at least part of what's going on now, please pick up a copy of this book.
Is it still in print?
Oh, yeah. It's still in print. You can get it from Vintage. I got this copy in 2008. So it's like it's been reprinted several times. It started with articles that were written in the 50s, actually. Mm. And then was, you know, what do you call it, coalesced into this book.
The title again, please.
It's called The Paranoid Style in American Politics by Richard Hofstadter, Hofstadter. And I just want to read a quote that he is talking about. Goldwater The title of this chapter is Goldwater and Pseudo-Conservative Politics. He is calling what Goldwater was doing pseudo-conservative, false conservative. He says, moderate Republicans are more likely to be officers or employees of large corporations whose positions leave them less time for partisan activity. Hence, the party in some sections of the country has gravitated into the hands of a leadership that is considerably more conservative than its voters. And we've seen that directly, that, you know, the people who are running the MAGA movement are way to the right of even mainstream conservative Republicans. So, and it says, one more quote, it says, the conservative label and the nationalist animus, or hatred from nationalists, of the far right are handsome advantages. It can wrap itself in the symbols of respectability and Americanism, and yet it has no inhibitions about gaining what it can through intimidation, which it brings to bear with great effectiveness upon school teachers and school administrators, librarians, advertisers in the press and mass media, local merchants, and working politicians.
Wow, now, that sounds very timely.
Very timely. And the guy, like I said, he was writing 50 years ago. So, and unfortunately, the man died early. I saw his dates. I guess he was in his 50s when he passed away. They didn't say how or why. You can almost guarantee that it wasn't on the barricades. You know, he was a tenured professor of history. It's a shame because he had such a rich imagination and a rich way of analyzing current events. Of course, he goes back, you know, anything before 1963, and the whole free silver thing, you know, the last chapter, like I was saying, that was too arcane for me. That was more for a professional historian or professional economist. But the rest of the book will illuminate your mind and open your eyes. So I recommend it.
Thank you, fellow worker Gordon.
Yeah, thank you.
And
yeah.
Next month, I think I am going to review a children's book, if you don't mind me doing a book review.
I don't mind doing that at all.
So for a bit of a hint about next month's book review, and I just kind of came up with this on the fly, I've been looking back through some of my old children's books, and there's a book that I really wanted to emphasize to the listener if you have any young children and you want to teach them about collective action or something like that. It's called Click Clack Moo, Cows That Type. So I'll give you all a chance to look that one up, and I'll do a full book review on it at our next episode of WOB Radio, because for a children's book, it's very unionist at its core, and I used to remember reading that as a kid in elementary school, so kind of a hint for our next episode.
Well, our fellow workers out there in Kitsap, we've already held a couple of events for children specifically out there. Fellow worker, shout out to fellow worker Kit. Oh, that reminds me, I wanted to make an announcement about the first annual Kitsap Anarchist Book Fair. It's happening May the 4th, and I'm going to get further details to fellow worker Noah here, and he can probably add that into when we record the broadcast, and then we edit it, and then we broadcast it over the air. So it can be cleaner and more professional. So I'm going to send him the details as they come in, but keep it on your calendar. First annual, first ever, Kitsap Anarchist Book Fair, probably in Bremerton.
So we need to send some love out into Bremerton, right?
Yes, we do. Bremerton needs all the love it can get.
Yeah.
So moving on from here in our show, fellow worker Lynn and I recently did an interview. This is part of an ongoing series that we hope to have here on WOB Radio going forward. It was kind of a joint project between myself, fellow worker Noah, and a few other fellow workers who really wanted to document those of us who have been part of the labor movement for a long time now, to kind of reflect on the histories that they've lived through, whether that's their work history, their work with unionism as a whole. So fellow worker Lynn and I sat down a couple of weeks ago just to talk about her involvement in the IWW and what that's meant for her. So here we go. Hello, fellow listeners, and thank you again for tuning into WOB Radio. My name is fellow worker Noah, and today, as part of an interview series, I'm here with fellow worker Lynn, who's been one of our longer time members here in the Tacoma branch.
Hi, I'm Lynn, and I'm a proud IWW member. And WOB Radio means wobbly radio, and the IWW has been known as the Wobblies forever. Maybe not literally forever. And anyway, I was a member in about 2007, and I was working two jobs, and I was pretty broke, and finally I just could never go to meetings or anything, so I just stopped going, and I shouldn't have stopped contributing, but I was pretty broke. And so anyway, I withdrew, and then years later, I've come back to it, partly through a fellow worker, Marilyn, that she gets me involved in everything. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so I've been involved since, I think, 2018, mm-hmm. maybe 19, and I'm happy to be part of it. It's a real welcoming group. Lots of intelligent people and really caring and committed people, committed to peace and justice and revolution if necessary. I'm not in that camp as much, but the Wobblies are fairly revolutionary.
And you are currently listening to Radio Tacoma 101.9 FM KTAH. So if you could maybe take us back a little bit in time, what was your early work experience like in life? Like, where did your career kind of take you, and how did you eventually find your way towards unionism?
Well, I always wanted to be a social worker. I didn't know, like, what type or what setting, but I knew I wanted to work, for the state, and I wanted to be a social worker, work with people that had issues, problems, things that I could help them solve. And so anyway, I got out of college. I couldn't find a job. It turned out that it was a layoff year for Boeing. And so people that get laid off from Boeing often go to work for the state. Anyway, they weren't hiring hardly anything. And I did get a job based on my degree at Purdy Prison back in 1972. I was about 25 then.
Purdy Prison?
Mm-hmm. And I worked there for, it was a CETA job, so I worked there for 6 months. And I'm glad that the time ended because it wasn't a good setting for me. But I did what I could. I even played a little guitar and taught a couple to sing and play a few songs. Anyway, then I got a job finally as a beverage server, and that was kind of fun, where they're playing live music. And then later I became a food service. I didn't think I could be a food server because I have a hot temper, and I figured the first person who insulted me, I'd spill soup on them or something. Anyway, I found that I could handle it pretty well, and I was making really good tips at this new restaurant in Tacoma called Alfie's Salmon House, and later Tacoma Salmon House. And it was quite the rage, and so I made some good tips there on weekends, and I saved them up. Minimum wage was $1.50 an hour, so I lived on that.
Oof.
I had no possessions. I had a car, but I didn't have toys. They didn't have stuff like they have now. Anyway, then I saved money, and I went to South America and lived in Colombia for 3.5 years. And one of my passions is singing, so I sang and played guitar, and I also played with bands down there. Anyway, really liked the experience. Came back in 1978, and I thought, well, I better get a resume going, you know, something like a professional life. So I did some volunteering in social service settings, and eventually I was hired by the county, and I was a case manager, social worker, and we unionized while I was working there. And that was AFSCME, and I think since then they have changed different union, but that was what it was when I was there. I left that job after 17 years and was over 20 years in social work, and I kind of burned out, and I needed to not have a lot of clients that have a lot of problems. I just had kind of done what I could. So I worked as a paraeducator in the Clover Park School District, and I was a member of a union there. Then I retired a few years ago, and I was a medical interpreter, but we didn't unionize. There's a branch that did, but they worked for L&I, and I wasn't part of that. So I'm a union maid. My dad was a longshoreman. His brother was a longshoreman. Their stepdad was a longshoreman. And I totally believe in unions and the IWW. I like inclusivity and fairness and equity and good working conditions, a fair day's labor for a fair day's work. So that's kind of been my life, my working life.
Mm-hmm. Now, could you remind me again how you got into the IWW?
Well, I honestly don't remember for 2008. I think I just knew about it. I don't even know how, because we didn't have Facebook or anything that I knew of back then, and I wasn't on email. It might have been Marilyn, because I knew her then.
She knows, she's pretty good at motivating you good. To get you to do something.
She is, yeah. IWW twice and then WAB Radio. Well, before that, Radio Tacoma.
Mm-hmm.
And then WAB Radio. So, but this time around, in about 2018, when I rejoined, it was largely Marilyn. And then since I've been in, we've gone camping, a bunch of us, and just had some fun activities that I feel bonded with the group. And then I've done a few activities with other IWW groups. I don't have a lot to say about it, but I really enjoy our meetings even. And we're trying to expand our local branch right now. And we've had a rummage sale. What did we have?
We had a fundraiser back in mid-December.
That was it, a fundraiser.
Mm-hmm. So I guess in terms of your experience being in the IWW, what keeps you being a wobbly? What encourages you to kind of, you know, participate as much as you do in the branch? What about the mission really kind of drives you?
Well, there's just so many poor people in our society, and it doesn't have to be that way. People are just, when they work hard, they should be compensated for it in a just way. And there's so much that is not that way. And the inequity is getting more pronounced, bigger divisions. And I'm aware of one thing, that the more spread apart the income is, as far as the really rich and the super poor, the more disparity that there is between those two ends of the spectrum, the less stable the society is. And no one wants that, a less stable society. It's just something that I like the people now that I've been involved with. And I like the mission of making working life better for all, every color, every faith, every sex. I really like that kind of thing. It just blends into my personal values.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, the IWW really likes to call itself a revolutionary union. We're not just trying to organize shops and industries. We're talking about trying to form one big union so that we can shape the course of production and society as a whole. I guess, what does that look like to you, and what do you look forward to in the future for the IWW?
Well, there seems to be an upward trend in union interest and joining participation. If that trend can continue, we're doing workplace organizing. Many of our workers that are not retired are doing that. Those who are retired, more background activities, I believe. I'm not sure how active some of the members that I know are in actual workplace organizing, but the people that are working are very committed, working within the limits that they can. Sometimes it won't work out with a group, and other times it does, their success. I mean, I would like to see the IWW take over for other unions, because I think it's the best one and it's the most inclusive and fair. It includes many crafts and many industries, not just, you know, it's not just like the electricians union. So going forward, I would like to see every worker in the United States unionized. And ideally, it would be mostly IWW unionizing. Everybody should have a shot at, everybody should get decent wages that keep up with the times and the area that they live in. There should be a possibility of a retirement, some comfort after we retire. Social Security, they're playing with it. We don't know whether it'll continue or how it will be funded or whether. If we have our own, and can't really depend on the stock market, not everybody's equipped for that, but there should be a retirement. And many industries do have that now, but not all.
Right. It's become the 401k, not so much like a pension directly from the company.
Right.
Yeah. So I guess if there's one more thing you wanted to say to all of our listeners and fellow workers out there, what would it be?
Join a union. Join the IWW. You'll feel good, and it'll benefit you in many ways.
Thank you so much, fellow worker Lynn. This has been great to do an interview with you. For all of our listeners here on WAB Radio, I really appreciate you being here, telling your story, and telling us about your time in the Wobblies.
Thank you, Noah.
Moving forward here in our show, we have a roundtable discussion. Now, I think this one is interesting because we have hinted at this at a couple of conversations over the past few episodes. I want to well, we are all going to talk about for a roundtable discussion about this relationship between the IWW, the AFL-CIO, and trade unionism as a whole. Because something that we've talked about in the past few episodes is how a lot of the IWW's ideas around the ethics of union organizing, the tactics of union organizing, and perhaps the biggest question, what is the future of organized labor going to look like?
Right.
There's been this interesting little bleed of IWW-related ideas into the AFL-CIO and other trade unions that aren't affiliated with them, but are still part of it.
We need a new song that goes, "I told you so."
We'll have to add that to the new edition of the Little Red Songbook. But it is interesting because, you know, I talk to trade unionists nowadays, especially younger members who are, you know, very fired up and interested in getting a union in their workplace. But they're also talking about going back to industrial unionism.
Yes.
And looking back on older tactics like the sit-down strike, the solidarity strike, the general strike, which there's one announced every 6 months on Twitter, and then, of course, it falls apart. But I think that it's interesting because, for me personally, as somebody who's a dual carder in both the Teamsters and the IWW, I think that there are unique opportunities for cross-organizational organizing, to use maybe a little bit too much academic language in one sentence. I don't know. Opening it up to the roundtable, what do we think the relationship with the IWW and the rest of the trade unions could look like? Because it kind of seems like
there is
one,
a longing for the strength that union organizing used to have.
Yep.
But they got that strength by being willing to stick their necks up.
Mm-hmm.
And stand up for things that they knew they needed and that they had to have. So some of that is nostalgia on the part of trade unions. But some of that is realization. I was joking with the "I told you so." They look back and say, well, there was a solidarity then.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a solidarity across
the labor
trades.
Movement. Yeah.
And because the corporate bosses have gotten so strong internationally and nationally and so moneyed with the weakening of some of the defenses that we had against monopolies.
Right, antitrust.
That they're exactly, antitrust, that we have to increase solidarity. How can we do that? And they look at the IWW and they see that some of the principles that led to the tactics that we used and the strategies were effective. So that once now there's finally an interest in what is an industrial union.
Maybe we should
We should define what that is.
Okay. When we talk about industrial unionism, when we have defined it before, we're talking about organizing by industry. And that was in our preamble that I read earlier. And by that, I use an example typically. Let's look at the airline industry. This is one of the easiest ones, where the pilots have a union, the mechanics have a union, the baggage handlers have another union, the flight attendants have their union, and they are prohibited by the Taft-Hartley Act from actually working together. And that's a hierarchical and undemocratic way to organize a union.
And divisive.
Very divisive. I mean, just as recently as 2011, there was a local ILWU action down in Longview. And what happened is another AFL-affiliated union came in and offered to take over their work. So in other words, one AFL-CIO union was scabbing on the other. So when you organize industrially, it's also called horizontal organizing, which means that we don't have a top-down hierarchy. We elect all our officers, and if we don't like what they're doing, we can recall them, fire them, essentially. We don't kick them out of the union. We just we remove them from their position of influence because they're not doing a good job. But you can't do that in another union. I was a member of the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, Local Lodge 282, out in the shipyard in Bremerton. I was a member for 30 years, and I never voted for anybody. It was all the few meetings that I went to, because I usually worked back shift. And that's when they had the meetings. The few meetings I went to were just like a kangaroo court, to me anyway. There were candidates for the stewards that I didn't know and didn't know anything about. And it was, okay, all those in favor, aye. All those opposed, no. No abstentions, slam of the gavel. Okay, you're now a union steward. and it was extremely undemocratic. And that is trade unionism. So if you want to look it up, look into the IWW.
I'd also just like to say, I know that you mentioned the preamble just a little while ago, which you read at the top of our episode. Thank you. And also, fellow worker Marilyn, you touched on this as well. The concentration of industries into fewer and fewer hands that control them.
Yeah.
We're seeing a return of these, I guess you wouldn't strictly call
robber
them...
robber barons.
Robber barons, yes.
The Gilded
but also
Age.
A very loose a collection of industries essentially forming a monopoly, but not with the structure of a monopoly,
right?
You know, you have maybe five or six major media corporations producing most of what we hear or see in social media and whatnot. You have only a handful of industries producing all of our food, a handful of industries producing all of our, you know, cars, what have you. There's this concentration of robber barons that essentially control the majority of what we produce. And as we also state in the preamble, the trade unions are unable to cope or strategize against that because of the way that they organize, because of the way that they structure themselves. Business unionism, as we call it. We want to structure ourselves like the businesses so that we can be just as effective, which has had...
But by what he's saying we, he doesn't mean the IWW.
No.
He's talking about trade unions.
Right. My apologies. But yeah, I think that it is interesting that, especially within the past few years, I got involved within the IWW because I saw things going on with police justice, racial justice, you know, a huge wave of people wanting economic equity in some way, you know, workers' control over the means of production and things like that. And I wanted to find my place in it, and I found the IWW was probably the most effective place for me personally. But the values and goals of the IWW are beginning to come back to the trade unions because suddenly, like we've touched on, you know, there's been a lot more militancy in the labor union. People are less afraid to confront their employers in the ways that they have in the past decades.
Hmm.
Or, you know...
I wonder why.
Well, if I was to give a why...
I think it's more desperation.
Yes, absolutely.
Also disappointment with their own union leadership. This democracy within unions is fairly recent. And, you know, the UAW comes to mind, United Auto Workers. They were once the powerhouse union in the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations. And they organized horizontally because they figured, hey, the guy putting the hubcaps on the Ford is in the same industry as the guy putting the engine block in a Chevrolet, and we should all be part of this, no matter what our trade, because they employ electricians and machinists and body people, that we should all be in the same union.
I think that, you know, for me, when I try to describe industrial unionism, I like to also look at something like a grocery store. You have the meat cutters in the deli department.
Right.
You have people doing custodial work, stocking people in the back in the warehouse section of like an Albertsons or a Fred Meyer or something. A trade union would typically look at those individual crafts or trades
separate.
And say, you know, you can organize with these people. You're probably best to organize with these people. You'll have separate unions within a workplace that have separate contracts with their employer.
I look at schools, and I look at the separation of the teachers from the parent educators, from the school bus drivers, from the lunch workers, from the secretaries, and it just, they're all working for the children. They all have a common boss. Why not work together in solidarity? Why strike a contract for the benefit of the teachers and leave the paraeducators hanging? Why strike a contract for the teachers and leave the bus drivers desperate?
Right. I mean, just with the Tacoma Arts Museum workers who just recently organized, one of the big stipulations of their organizing campaign was, hey, we want the security guards in on this,
That's
too.
That's right.
Because the security guards escort us to our vehicles. They make sure that we stay safe.
Security guards provide better security for the workers.
Exactly. And they had solidarity with them because they worked together every day.
Worked for the same outfit.
I think another observation that personally I've also had, I think a lot of the return of the IWW's values as well, it is kind of that class conscious approach to organizing as well. you know, people even outside of their specific industry are looking at other industries and saying, oh, that's happening to the workers in that particular workplace, but that's similar to what's happening to me. We're also both struggling to pay our rent. We're struggling to pay for groceries.
You know, this is strongly worded, but I think it's pretty effective. We have a common enemy. And when we realize that we have a common enemy, which is the corporate fat cats that keep us scared and insecure and make our lives so stressful. When we have a common enemy and we unite together, we just might have a damn chance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you'll notice that these days, I'm really very pleased about the education system, especially higher ed. The big news recently was that certain athletes at certain schools have been successful in getting themselves classified as employees for the university, and so they can form a union. Well, that's just part of it. I didn't know until about 10 years ago about grad students. Full disclosure, I didn't go to college. I didn't go to a four-year college. I went through an apprenticeship, which was probably better. But what I'm getting at is that they're organizing with the United Steelworkers. They don't have anything to do with the steel mill, mm-hmm. you know, or AFGE, or United Food and Commercial Workers. You know, these are all, it's better than not having a union at all, although they'd probably be better off forming their own. This at least gives them a little bit of political clout, and when they go to bargain with the universities, which have become corporations. Mm-hmm. You know, we like to have these, you know, quaint images in our mind that, you know, the doddering old professor with his elbow patches and everything and smoking a pipe. And these images we have of the academic world are no longer true. They're all run like corporations, and a lot of them are run for profit. And it's horrendous how they end up treating their grad students like low-paid wage workers, which is pretty much what they are. So if you have an opportunity to organize with another union besides the IWW, take it. And you can also be a dual card and join us.
You know, I've been reading through some of our older union history as well. I know that especially for those of us who have any kind of background in left-wing history or labor history, there's a name, William Z. Foster.
Oh, yeah.
In his early organizing with the IWW, kind of came up with this idea of bore from within the trade unions to try and take it towards a more revolutionary angle. Change the structure from inside, work within the system, quote-unquote, and then eventually we can change it in a direction where we want to go. I think that that's still kind of one of the big elephant in the room kind of questions that still hangs in the air, because mm-hmm. even though Foster himself later discounted that theory and went towards a more socialist and communist direction with parliamentary socialism.
He joined the Communist Party. What happened?
Right. I still think that there is kind of that question of what do we think about that particular strategy? Because, you know, trying to change the system from within, we hear that conversation with, oh, we're just going to push the Democrats to the left once they're in office.
You know what? That was my experience. I thought I was going to enter the Democratic Party and I was going to pull it to the left. And what I found is they just wanted to suck up my energy mm-hmm. and spit me out.
And neutralize you.
Yeah.
That's mm-hmm. what happened to me with the 26th.
Yeah. And that could easily happen.
Well, I know someone who's really interested. He's really homebound, but he really wants to be involved. He's very radically left, appropriately so. And he he tried to volunteer to take on a position, and I don't remember what the position was. And so he took some vacancy that there was, and he found that just nobody did anything in his experience in that office.
Right.
He had big computer skills and all that, and maybe they just wanted that, but he didn't find them cooperative toward the causes. And so he got disaffected and left.
To further illustrate your point, Len, is that my brief involvement with the Democratic Party, I heard more anti-working class, you know, snippets of conversation. The predominant one being, why are these people voting against their own self-interest? And my reply is, why aren't you organizing? Why aren't you taking your message to the quote-unquote white working class, which they were disparaging?
I mean, I could add to that as well. I just recently read an article, and I wish that I could cite it off the top of my head. But speaking of, you know, trying to talk to people who have ideas or values which might seem contrary to our own, It was an article about, I want to say, ride shares and like grocery delivery companies and stuff like that.
Yeah, Uber.
Where there was this conservative guy within this particular group of rideshare people who wanted to organize, you know, definitely seemed more like the pro-Trump type, but he eventually came around to it and joined the union, not necessarily because of any particular ideological drive. You know, he didn't become a Marxist overnight, but it was because he just wanted a place to have some social company. He wanted a group of people that he could find fellowship and solidarity with. So he kind of joined the union through the lens of, I'm not big on this whole collectivism thing. You know, I still have very skeptical ideas about unions.
Mm-hmm.
That person still got involved anyway because he said, oh, this is an outlet for me to, like, spend time with other people who want to change the crap that we're going through together.
Exactly. They're all suffering from the same masters.
And I think turning it back towards the conversation with trade unions and what the, I, you know, do we bore from within? Do we still remain kind of I think personally, from my own opinion, the IWW needs to stay a separate organization, obviously. We have a different aim, we have a different goal, we have a different methodology that we hope to find effective in the labor movement of today. But I think in terms of our collaboration with the trade unions, I still think that there are great opportunities for us to at least work alongside with them.
Exactly. And act in solidarity. And another tip, if you want to support a local labor struggle, you know,
absolutely,
you can go on down to their picket line and you'll find out who the picket captain is or the person who's organizing stuff and just ask them. Say, hey, we're from the Wobblies, and we believe in your struggle. May we walk your picket line? If you show up in solidarity, even if you show up with a case of bottled water or an urn of coffee or something like that, and show your solidarity to your fellow workers, and they will appreciate it. Trust me, I've never been kicked off a picket line.
Oh, I just, you know, we can spend a lot of time verbalizing and talking about it, and that's important. But I love shorthand. An injury to one is an injury to all.
That's our slogan, one of our slogans.
We want to be out there in solidarity. If any worker is injured, and I don't mean necessarily physically, but it certainly can be, injured economically, injured socially, injured security-wise, and they have a beef, I'm going to be there. And speaking of which, I encourage anybody within earshot of this particular radio station, if you're listening locally, that La Lucha Continua down at the Northwest Detention Center, where the hunger strike is ongoing and La Resistencia is in hunger strike along with the workers. If you want to go down it, now that we've got daylight savings time at 7 in the evening, that's when the group is most active. They would love your solidarity and your support. Mm-hmm. And you can bring down fruit juice that has a lot of pulp in it because they can drink that while they're hunger striking.
I think that there is a lot of great opportunity for cross-solidarity work. I mean, I've worked other unions. I've walked other unions' picket lines. I've provided the water bottles and mutual aid to workers on picket lines. I've sat in on Central Labor Council meetings. If you know where your local union hall is, trade union hall, or a local Central Labor Council like we have in Tacoma.
Or any other social struggle.
Or any other social struggle as well. Sit in on a meeting. Listen to what people are talking about. A lot of these events are open to the public. Definitely listen to the workers, the people who are in the working class around you, as well as at these particular institutions. You know, get a sense of the common struggle that we're all kind of going through and be a part of the action that changes those people's situations.
So can we go ahead and do announcements then?
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead.
Okay. April 15th, 5 o'clock, the Federal Courthouse in Tacoma. They are having a tax day rally in Tacoma against the military budget.
Mm-hmm.
And they would like people's support. Physicians for Social Responsibility.
Oh, okay.
And Democratic Socialists of America. And they've also asked for Veterans for Peace endorsements, which I will bring up tomorrow. And I am also going to ask the IWW if they're interested in endorsing this rally.
When
so that's April 15th, 5 p.m.,
oh,
the Federal Courthouse. Now, this is Earth Month, and things are happening. And I'm not sure yet just where and what. I'm sure it's up here And maybe I'll be able to add this later on in an addendum to this month's broadcast. But I want to remind the listener that Veterans for Peace has a wonderful sailboat called the Golden Rule, 20-foot long sailboat. And the purpose of the Golden Rule is to draw attention to and educate people about how insane nuclear weapons are. And they are doing their West Coast tour up and down the West Coast, of course. They will be in Tacoma on August 13th. They'll be all day, and then they'll overnight, and then they'll leave on the 14th. We don't have a location yet. Stay tuned. If you want to find out more information, you can contact VFP Chapter 134 on Facebook.
Veterans for Peace.
Veterans for Peace, Chapter 134. And it will be August 13th.
That's interesting to note, fellow worker Marilyn, because that's after August 6th through 9th, mm-hmm. which is also an outfit out in Kitsap County called Ground Zero.
Oh, yeah.
And they have an action on Hiroshima Day
right.
every year and Mother's Day. They actually do an action, and it's kind of ritualized. They actually lie down in the middle of the road at the Trident submarine base.
Yeah.
And they block traffic. Now, it's all pretty formalized and ritualized. They have an agreement with the base and the base security so that they're going to get arrested. Mm-hmm. And it's all formalized. There's no head knocking going on. But they do an action where they deliberately block traffic into the submarine base. And that's getting pretty risky these days.
Well, Father Bix went to prison yes. for that for a long time.
I remember Father Bix.
Right. Yeah.
He's quite a guy. Yeah. I have I'm going to reiterate my one announcement, which was the Kitsap Anarchist Book Fair. And I wanted to give a shout out to fellow worker Billy, who organizes an outfit called Sabotage Noise Productions. And if for all you punk rockers out there, I don't think that's too many people at this table, but for all you punkers out there, that outfit puts on some really good shows at the Charleston Theater. And also this new Anarchist Book Fair thing, which I'm going to have details coming later. So check out, shout out to fellow worker Billy, and keep the work going, and you know, solidarity forever.
Alrighty, fellow workers, thank you so much for tuning in. Once again, this is WOB Radio, a production of the Tacoma branch of the Industrial Workers of the World. This is a broadcast also being put out through 101.9 Radio Tacoma, 95.3 KTQA, and 94.9 KZAX, KZAX, up in Bellingham. We want to thank you all for tuning in once again. Hope you stay safe, get agitated, and get organized. Solidarity.
Solidarity forever.